welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. Today we are going to be discussing in our series of serial killers, the case of the murder of Elizabeth Short, better known as the Black Dahlia. And I just wanted to give a couple of warnings before we start, because the subject matter we are about to discuss is extremely graphic and disturbing. This is not suitable listening for minors, and frankly, for anyone else that considers themselves sensitive to these topics, they should seriously consider whether they want to continue. We are discussing this case out of our interest in the history and social context of the time, and we want to stress that we have the utmost respect for the victim, in this case, Elizabeth Short. A second warning that we kind of all considered important here is that we're going to be discussing Elizabeth Short's life and her behavior and her actions. And we're going to probably discuss that in some detail and come to some conclusions about that. But at no time do any of us want to lose sight of the fact that, Elizabeth Short was the innocent victim here. And she was always the victim of this horrible crime. And throughout history, she's kind of been portrayed in ways that she got what she deserved, or she got what was coming to her because of her behavior. And we don't condone that at all. She was the innocent victim, and the only one here at fault is the killer or killers. And now I'm just going to let everyone introduce themselves. I'm Thomas F.T. Ward on the podcast of Ice and Fire Forms, and today I'm joined by...
I'm Julia. I am no true lady on the forums.
And I'm Bina 007 on the forums.
Hey, you know, before we jump into this really unpleasant stuff, I was thinking we should do some, like, happy updates on the larger podcast family. So one of our fellow vassals, Matt, who was supposed to be here today with us but couldn't make it, he recently got engaged, so good for him. And also on the main podcast, Mimi and her now husband, Ian, are expecting a baby boy in August. So I thought those were some nice things that we should do shout out to.
Yeah, congratulations awesome. To Matt and Yvonne and Mimi. That's amazing news.
Yeah, yes. Some sunlight.
Mm-hmm. Someone cut in the chorus from the Circle of Life here at this point. podcast.
Okay, so I'll just go briefly into the setting of where this murder took place, and then we'll just kind of work our way back through the entirety of the case and what our thoughts are. Okay, on the morning of Wednesday, January 15th, 1947, in the Limert Park neighborhood of Los Angeles, California, a mother named Betty Bursinger and her young child were on their way to the market when Miss Bursinger saw what she thought at the time was a broken mannequin in a vacant lot ahead. As she got closer, she began to suspect that it might not be a mannequin at all. And she went to the, started knocking on some of the doors in the neighborhood and eventually found a house where she could call the police. She called in to the dispatch, and shortly afterwards, Communications Division of Los Angeles Police Department sent out a call for a, it was kind of a jumbled exchange, and they sent out a call for a drunk woman passed out naked in an empty lot. And that, I believe, was around, about 10:30 a.m. she saw the body, and that was around 10:45 or so, I think, that call went out. It was received by police officers in the that police division in Los Angeles, but it was first intercepted by some local newspaper writer and his photographer who were driving through the neighborhood, and they had a police scanner in their car. So legend has it those were the first people actually on the crime scene, and when they got there, they discovered that the murdered, mutilated, and surgically bisected body of a young Caucasian woman. And that's kind of where the story generally begins, and that was kind of a lot of me talking, but if you guys want to say anything about that first initial discovery of the crime scene or anything else.
Only, I suppose, that the body was deliberately left to be found. It was posed very carefully. Her hair had been washed, the blood had been drained. This was not an act. Sometimes you think of serial killers as committing these escalating acts of uncontrolled frenzy and savagery, but this was very deliberate and cool. And that when she was first identified, when you read the first newspaper reports, they identify her as a young teenager, even though she was in her 20s. And I think that it's a very vulnerable way to be found. I mean, the other thing I suppose we should say is that for years, I think the first newspapers that published the pictures, they kind of airbrushed in her body being covered by a blanket. And they airbrushed out some of the damage to her face. But I mean, sadly, tragically for Elizabeth Short, it's incredibly easy to come across those photographs now on the internet and in various books. And I think for anyone who's listening to this and thinks they might do a Google search, be prepared, because it's incredibly graphic. But I almost feel it's necessary, in a sense, if you're interested in this, to force yourself to look at it, because you get something of an understanding of the nature of the crime. I mean, even for people who sort of do a lot of reading about serial killers, it's just incredibly specific in what happened, and unpleasant and awful to think about. So yeah, that's all I kind of wanted to add.
What I was going to say is that just from all that context, it's fairly obvious that the body was left there, not dumped, but left there, and with the intention of it being found. And there's all these other details that we'll probably get into about the way the body was left, other than being bisected, and there were some the facial mutilations, there were other mutilations to the body, to her face, and very, I think, would be characterized as a ritualistic killing.
Yeah,
possibly.
And surreal.
Yeah, do we want to just kind of do a detailed kind of explanation of what happened to the body? Again, as Bina said, this is a posed corpse. There's no other way to look at it, because of the surgical bisection, you know, the organ should have just spilled out if it was just dumped, but that's not the case. Everything was neatly tucked in. Everything was meticulously posed. The body was exsanguinated, drained of blood, cleaned.
For those who do not want to Google the crime scene, which I don't blame you at all for, basically, the body was spread eagle on the ground. The legs sort of spread apart, the arms sort of spread apart, the head back. And even though her body had been bisected at the waist, it was posed in such a way that it was sort of like a continuous line, like you would have expected it to be a whole body, but it looked like a mannequin that had been broken apart and set on the ground. That's very much what it looked like. So do you want to talk about what when they looked over her body, you were talking about how it had been cleaned and exsanguinated, which means the blood had been drained.
Also, the fact that the knees were broken, a kind of hysterectomy had been performed, like she's missing certain important vital organs, but also that there were...
I don't believe she's actually missing any organs. That's my understanding, she's not missing any organs, but...
Really?
But again,
it's... Contested,
the
maybe.
The facts in the case are a little hard to come by. I think we all
have noticed that.
There's no great book about it, and you really have to dig for the facts. My understanding is that all the organs were intact, and if anything was missing at all, it might have been her right breast was slashed and removed,
But it's true that she had been tortured, right? So there were.
Absolutely.
She had been maybe for days tortured in terms of.
Yeah, she had been tortured while she was still alive. You can tell by bruising. Obviously, bruises only form when your heart is beating and blood is pumping in your body. So they could tell kind of which wounds were while she was alive and which wounds were post-mortem. And she was beaten badly in the head and body. She was slashed, I'll just say, in parts of her body, and then her mouth was, as we said, was cut open from ear to ear while she was alive. And I think after that, everything else was post-mortem. She died from the wounds to her head and from shock and loss of blood.
Yeah,
and the wounds to her mouth are sometimes called the Glasgow smile, is sort of a... everyone saw The Dark Knight. What the Joker had, the scars on his face, that's sort of that, yes.
It's weird though, because I never, well, I would refer to that as a Chelsea smile. But,
yeah, I've heard it referred to as both.
Yeah.
So, again, the first uniformed officers arrived then, and they called in directly to their superiors when they realized exactly how horrific and different this crime was. And then I think two detectives, local detectives, were sent to the location. But pretty quickly, within an hour, I think 11:30 or so, Central Homicide sent Detectives Phineas Brown, if I'm pronouncing that right, and Harry Hansen to the case. And they arrived again around 11:30 a.m. And often if you see pictures of the crime scene, you'll see these two guys there. And they remained the lead detective on the cases until ultimately they retired.
Mm. Do we want to say something about the context of the LAPD at the time?
Sure. So maybe we'll just talk a little bit about the setting, I guess, of Los Angeles and post-war America at the time. This is obviously 1947, the beginning of January 1947. The war is recently ended, World War II. The United States is kind of at the height of its power, really, kind of the separation between the United States, the only nuclear power. And the rest of the world is as great as it's ever going to be. You know, Europe and Asia are just digging out of the ruins of the war. And it's an interesting time of kind of social upheaval in the United States with, you know, hundreds of thousands of women had entered the workforce during the war, and they're kind of being exiting the workforce, sometimes forcibly, as the GIs return. And it's just a time of, again, America's at the height of its power, but it's the beginning of the social upheaval of the 50s and 60s. It's really beginning at this time. And Los Angeles itself, I guess, Bina, do you want to talk about maybe Los Angeles as kind of
as
an American city as you can really imagine?
I think that what's fascinating about this time, and when we think of, you know, we've just recently discussed H.H. Holmes and before Jack the Ripper, that I think America's demobilizing. You've got lots of GIs milling the streets, coming back. You've had relationships disrupted by the war. And then I think you have Los Angeles, which is, because of Hollywood, being the city that attracts people who want to make it big, who want to become stars, and maybe are a little bit vulnerable young women who are coming there with dreams and maybe delusions of a city. And then they're coming up against a city which at this particular time has even more than usual influx of, you know, young men maybe looking for a good time. So it feels like it's a place that's almost beyond conventional bourgeois morality, where somehow, you know, types of behavior you can get away with. There's a seamier side than maybe even is typical. And you have an institutional environment in LA where, when I've been reading these books about it, it feels like a very small town where everyone knew everyone. But
It's very much an industry town, right? It's got that feel that instead of a factory or something, though, it's the Hollywood entertainment industry. Yeah.
And that's very much how it still is, believe it or not. Yeah. I mean, the confines, the border of the city has grown, you know, to encompass all these other outlying areas, this greater Los Angeles area. But, I mean, for example, if you go to visit Los Angeles, don't be surprised if when you're sitting at dinner with your friend who you're visiting or relative, you suddenly realize that all the other people at dinner with you were all in the entertainment industry. Yeah. That's just, you know, I remember one time I was down there. I was with my friend who, you know, directs, he's the manager of a casting firm. And then there was someone working with Hans Zimmer. And it was just, it was just like, wow, this is really how it is down here.
But what's even more amazing is that it's this kind of, it feels to me like there's these three sort of sources of power. There's Hollywood, and then there's like, the criminal power, the criminal underworld, and then there's the LAPD, and the links are just unbelievably interlinked and corrupt. I think if any of you have ever heard Claudius the Fool talking about podcasts, he loves a sort of a comic history podcast called The Dollop, and they've done, I think, four episodes on the history of the LAPD. But if you listen to the first one, where they do kind of its establishment, and you realize that it's this very new institution, kind of at that point, and to its core, at its very founding, is this concept of big businessmen, real estate developers as they develop this town, mafia, people running girls and drugs, and you know, everything that surrounds the city and makes it function is somehow interlinked. These men all know each other, and it's not that you get this. I mean, like, for instance, in the case of Jack the Ripper, these were poor, unfortunate women who were drifters and were killed. But Scotland Yard made mistakes and bungles, but it genuinely wanted to find out who the killer was. Like, I don't think it was a corrupt organisation. I'm not saying that the detectives here didn't want to find out who the Dahlia is, and I'm not saying that there was this big conspiracy they were in cover-up, although that's what some have posited. But you just get this feeling that it's this, the system of justice kind of is working, but it's very gummy, it's very sticky, and it may, like, the chances of it happening, the complicity of the press in particular, is just amazing to me. And I guess I should have mentioned that as the fourth estate or the fifth estate. I mean, it's amazing to me how, you know, like, paying for leads, getting information in advance of the press, the way in which the press inserted themselves into the case is shocking to me. And I think, Thomas, you were talking about that, right? Like, the Hearst press.
Yeah, you can't almost overstate how interlinked, as Bina said, the organs of power in Los Angeles were at this time. Industry, big business, the newspapers, which often represented, like the LA Times, is the conservative kind of representation of the power, old style power. The newspapers, the police, the mayor, the DA, organized crime, these are all interlinked. I mean, the LAPD, certainly before this time, there's kind of a gang war raging at this time, but the LAPD and Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department were the bagmen for organized crime at this time. They were the muscle, they were the hitmen. They literally, LAPD existed more to install the order than to enforce the laws at this time. That's my opinion.
That's a great way of putting it.
Argue it, but it's really hard to imagine how corrupt everything was here.
It's hilarious. There's a bit of, I was listening to Dollop Part 1 this morning where one of the comedians, like, what, you're trying to tell me that the Chinese mafia did not have to pay off the LAPD, they didn't have to bribe them, because they were literally using them to go and pick up the money that they were extorting from people. I mean, it was literally co-opted. They were employees. They were on the payroll.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite.
And the only way to advance in the LAPD past a certain point was to play that game. There
for
was
sure.
a very much a ceiling to what an honest cop could go. I mean, once you got up to the higher levels, they're doling out patronage only to people that are playing this game. And at this time, like I said, there's an actual gang war kind of raging between the old organized crime that had established itself since the beginning of Los Angeles, all through Prohibition, and now kind of the East Coast Syndicate, led by, you know, Luciano and Lansky, and they're represented on the West Coast by Bugsy Siegel, and then Mickey Cohen eventually, because Bugsy Siegel obviously is going to be assassinated shortly after this. But so there's really, I mean, we'll talk about maybe the gangster squad and stuff, and they've got kind of this idealized version that they were fighting the mafia. But the truth of the matter is they're political police that were fighting the Luciano syndicate mafia and protecting the established, corrupt, already existing LAPD-supported existing organized crime in the city.
Yeah.
And again, I read a book a few years ago called L.A. Noir, which I would highly recommend to anyone that's interested in the subject. It's a little, it kind of covers L.A. maybe for too long, so it's kind of over ambitious. But the parts that it covers here in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, it's amazing. I mean, you can't believe the stuff that was going on here in this city at this time.
Yeah, and it is a big difference, isn't it? Because I think once H.H. Holmes is caught for insurance fraud or you know, gets his... You've got no illusion that he is going to be prosecuted and that the criminal justice system wheels are going to turn and ultimately come to the right conclusion. And the same with, like, Jack the Ripper or any of these things. It's sort of... This was a shocking crime to me because it was... Number one, you get your head around the horrific things that this girl suffered. And then you realize that as a young girl coming to L.A. at that point... and, you know, we can talk about her family or lack thereof. You really had no, there was no social safety net. There was no criminal justice safety net. You were on your own. And I think that gave various cohorts and people in town a lot of confidence to do whatever they wanted to do. And, you know, you can point to different suspects for the murder, but I think the thing that we can draw in common with some of them is a feeling of protection, that they could just, it was free reign. If you were a man of a certain level of power, you could just do what you wanted to do.
I think we can sum it up with, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's amazing. You know, James Ellroy exaggerates and gets lots of stuff wrong, but deliberately so. But the one thing he doesn't exaggerate is just the level of intense corruption.
Yeah, he's telling a story, right? He's not trying to do history. And we talked about that with Jack the Ripper a bit, with like From Hell and stuff. He's telling a story, and you shouldn't read Ellroy as fact or anything, but it's, I mean, you know, Chinatown, L.A. Confidential, those are worth seeing to try and get an idea of kind of the level of interconnected corruption at this time in Los Angeles, especially.
Absolutely.
And even a movie like Mulholland Drive, which is obviously not, it's not very realistic. It's, you know, it's a David Lynch movie. But there's also a lot of truth in it about just what Los Angeles is. So do you want to talk about who Elizabeth was a little bit? We alluded to her being this sort of unmoored orphan to an extent, who had a really rough life.
Yeah,
I can talk about that a little bit.
Why don't we just do the next day and kind of how her identity was discovered, and then and then we'll go back and do Elizabeth Short's life and upbringing, if that works for you guys.
Yeah. That's great. Let's do it.
Does anyone want to tell the story of how her fingerprints were found and all that? It's an interesting story. I don't know if anyone wants to do it.
I wanted to talk about her background, so if you want to talk about how her identity was discerned.
Yeah.
Okay, so originally Elizabeth Short's identity was not known. She was just Jane Doe number one, which I think signifies she's the first unknown female
of the year. Yeah.
Corpse of the year in Los Angeles. Again, as Bina alluded to, you really couldn't show pictures of her body or face in the paper because she was horribly beaten and mutilated. So there was an issue with identification of the body. I think they actually put like a artist's rendering of what her face might have looked like. But so they were a little troubled of how to get an identification out to the public. So it ended up that we're going to talk about the newspapers quite a bit, but James Richardson was the city editor for the Los Angeles Examiner, which I think was the Evening Hearst paper.
Yes.
Again, this is a different time when major American cities not just had one paper, but they had multiple papers in competition with each other. I think there were four major newspapers in Los Angeles at the time. And Hearst syndicate owned two of them, and the Examiner is central to the story of the Black Dahlia. But Richardson, with his contacts with LAPD, said that he could, it was a process called sound photo, which is basically a fax machine in 1947.
Yep, which was so amazing to me that they had that. I was like, wow, that's cool.
And of course, the police
don't have one.
And government don't have it, but the newspapers and the Hearst newspapers had this process. So what they did is they took Elizabeth Short's fingerprints and then they faxed them basically to the DC office of the Hearst newspaper in Washington, DC, who then gave them to the FBI. I think after a couple of tries pretty quickly, this is the next day, I guess, January 16th it would be, the FBI was able to locate Elizabeth Short's fingerprint records. Elizabeth Short had taken a job, I think, in 1943 at Camp Cook. I want to say it's 1943 in Camp Cook. And then she'd also been arrested in 1943 for being present underage while drinking was going on. I don't know if she was drinking herself. I think that's up for debate, but she was certainly present. So her fingerprints and her mugshots were on file with the FBI. And again, this is the newspaper. Then for their cooperation with the police. They got exclusive, you know, her name and face or, and all that stuff exclusively first, and were able to scoop the other papers on probably like on the 17th, I'm guessing. I don't really know when, but the next day after they had got all this information from the FBI. And this kind of is going to show time and again kind of the newspapers kind of working hand in hand with the police and also kind of getting out ahead of the police.
I also think it's quite significant because it's the manner of identification, which is being picked up for underage drinking, is one of those first elements that the newspapers will go on to use to create this Black Dahlia myth of this kind of, you know, very kind of promiscuous, dangerous, kind of seductive woman who put herself in dangerous positions. And rather than what they originally identified her as, which is this very vulnerable teenager on the first day of reporting. Yeah. So of course, you know, maybe she was just happened to be working at this place where there's underage drinking and wasn't really at fault. And actually some of the kind of friends' testimonies that actually she didn't really like drinking much, but it's this very start of what is going to become the Dahlia myth, as kind of, I guess, best encompassed in the Elroy kind of depiction of her.
Going to become, I mean, it's a highly sensational crime, and it's going to be highly sensationalized in the media. And there's no really other way to put it other than what Bina said, that she's going to be portrayed as this really promiscuous young woman on the prowl, is the quotes from the papers. And maybe it's worth, you know, stopping here. And Julia, maybe if you want to talk about who Elizabeth Short was, where she came from.
Yeah.
And how she ended up in Los Angeles in 1947.
Sure. So she was actually born in the Boston area. Her father's name was Cleo. That's interesting. So her mother's name was Phoebe. And her father was in the miniature golf course business, believe it or not, until the 1929 stock market crash. And that wiped him out. And then the following year, his car was found abandoned by a bridge, and it was assumed that he had committed suicide. Turns out that was not the case. And some years later, he resurfaced living in California. And so Elizabeth, she was not only a child, there were four other children, all daughters. And she had bronchitis and asthma issues. And back then, as is still now to an extent, you know, if you have allergies, if you have breathing problems, people seek out the warmer climates. And her family decided when she was about 19 that she would go move to Vallejo, California.
It's 16. I think it's 16 she moves to Florida.
Oh, yes, Florida.
So maybe I think it's worth getting out there that she moved out of home and really didn't have a stable home from the time she was 16.
Yes.
She moved to Florida for her health again.
Yes, and then ended up in Vallejo, which used to have a huge naval shipyard, which was where a lot of ships were built for World War II, and that's where her dad was. Interesting, Vallejo is actually close. I live in San Jose, so Vallejo was like an hour drive away. So then she and her dad ended up not getting along well, and she went down to Los Angeles, got that job at Camp Cook, which is now Vandenberg Air Force Base, and then ended up in Santa Barbara, which is a very nice town, but that's where she got picked up for the underage drinking allegations. And then she bounced around for a while. She got the authorities shipped her back to Massachusetts, and then she went back to Florida instead, making only occasional visits to Massachusetts, presumably to her mother and siblings. And then when she was in Florida, she met a certain Major Matthew Gordon Jr., an Air Force officer, and they were going to get married. And he died less than a week before Japan surrendered. So we got tragedy up, down, left, right.
Yeah, I always think what would her life have been like? That obviously, you know, unmoored from her mother and her hometown, she goes to LA, seeks her father, well, not LA, but goes to California, maybe with a kind of mythic picture of what it'd be like if she's with her dad in her mind, and that doesn't really come to much, and then falls for what seems to be like a fairly upstanding guy, and then he tragically dies, and, you know, obviously it's hard to kind of disentangle what you think you know about her from all the fictional kind of versions of her. But you kind of get the feeling that she just wanted to have a nice, stable relationship and a sense of belonging, and she probably would have been very happy with this guy. It's just horrible.
Yeah.
It's very tragic.
If he had lived and they had gotten married, we would never know her name.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, you get the impression from a lot of what remains of her letters that she was someone that just was looking to find someone to marry and have kind of a stable, normal life. And the whole thing with Matthew Gordon is really, really sad. It's a little up in the air whether they ever actually were engaged or not, I think. But it's clear that they did have a correspondence and a strong connection, and the possibility was there that they were going to get married when he came back from the war. But as you said, he's killed tragically in, I think, India or Burma, right at the end of the war.
So the contention for the listeners is that he never actually told his family he was engaged.
Yeah.
Which people think is, well, wouldn't you tell them? But
not necessarily.
I'm willing to think that in wartime, you know, maybe not everything is communicated. And I also feel that, you know, you can definitely find examples in her letters later where she describes herself as having been married, and where she maybe describes herself as being engaged to other guys. But I don't think it's like this malicious, willful lying. I think it's just, I think she's so desperate for belonging and to be in a relationship that I think it's kind of, it's very understandable and very authentic, you know, there but for the great, you know, if you're in grief,
yeah.
I think it's just very believable and not at all reprehensible. But that's...
No, not at all. I believe it entirely possible that he communicated to her by letter without his family's knowledge that he would, like, either directly or implied that he had every intention of spending, once he got back. Exactly. And
also, why would we assume that we have the complete communication?
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of letters, but why would we assume there aren't others, you know?
Yeah. And as we know, she is going to lie about stuff. I mean, there's no real way of getting around that fact. So
yeah, exactly.
There is a question, but I think it's perfectly plausible that they had every intention of getting married. And as you say, it's obviously a horrible tragedy for her, and her life could have obviously taken a very different turn at that point and ended up happy and anonymous instead of where she's going to end up.
Yeah. I feel that was sort of her last chance at being
moored
to something or having someone who actually cared, whether she had somewhere to stay that night and had money to pay the rent.
There were other men that she's going to pursue, and it's just never going to quite work out. Mm. Certainly there's this Gordon Fickling, I believe is how you pronounce it, who she's going to go west to, I think, Indianapolis, where they meet, and it just doesn't quite work out. And then she ends up going to Chicago, which is really a bizarre chapter, and I don't know how much we're going to talk about that, but her time in Chicago is extremely strange to me.
I think we need to talk about it a little bit because it gives such flavor to, again, how contingent her life was. She really was just blown around, and she was, in a sense, the perfect victim.
I don't know about the Chicago period. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I want to get the dates straight, but I think she leaves Florida. Let me see if I can find the actual dates. Leaves Florida to meet this Gordon Fickling, who I think is a lieutenant in the Army. Let me see if I can find the actual dates. I think it's like May of 1946. She ends up, after not working out in Indianapolis, she goes to Chicago, where she has encounters with several men who are involved with either police officers or newspaper men were involved with a series of murders in Chicago called the Lipstick Murders, I think.
Yeah.
And she claims to be, according to testimony, she claims that she is a reporter from Boston investigating the Lipstick Murders, which were, again, I think three serial crimes, including the final crime, which was the kidnapping, murder, and dismemberment of a young girl in Chicago.
A six-year-old girl. Really awful.
Yeah, really awful. And and a lot will be made in certain theories and conspiracies of why she's in Chicago and what she's interested in regarding these crimes. But I think the fact is she was there and she did had an interest in the men and these crimes. And it's strange that she will end up, you know, within a year
being a victim.
Dying in a very eerily similar fashion.
Yeah, in a similar murder. And I've never quite been able to wrap my head around it. I mean, certain people, obviously, with their suspects will have theories about what was going on here, but I can't for the life of me. It just seems so strange that she's going to be so interested in these series of crimes. And then she's going to herself be the victim of a similar crime. And I don't know if we want to talk about maybe just a little bit about the lipstick murders and the person who's convicted.
Because
it, again, it goes to kind of police awfulness. But eventually a man named William Herons is going to be arrested. And I think he eventually confesses to the three murders. The circumstances around his confession are kind of obscene. He's basically arrested, beaten, tortured, performed surgery on. They inject him with truth serum, just beat the crap out of him until he confesses to crimes that he doesn't even know the details to. I mean, if you read the kind of transcripts of the confessions, it'll be like, so then you killed her, right? And he'll be like, yeah, I strangled her. And then the police will be like, no, you didn't strangle her. You stabbed her, right? Yeah, I stabbed her then. It's just like,
it's a gross, gross miscarriage of justice, right?
Exactly. And the worst of it is, of course, probably the killer got away because the police, under pressure from the media and their superiors, just picked up some guy, beat a confession out of him, and then, you know, the actual murderer, it just gets away with the crime.
And again, to sort of to contrast with the Ripper murders, obviously, there is one theory that the police knew who it was but didn't capture or force a confession, but because they thought it would be incendiary, but it's just a totally opposite way of functioning, right?
Yeah, and the witnesses' testimony, it's just, you could do a podcast about the lipstick murders, but
we probably will at some point, but anyway.
But it nothing adds up, and you know, I don't, it's a strange kind of detour for Elizabeth Short, and whether it has direct connection to the Black Dahlia murder later or not is kind of what theories you want or what suspect you want to look at. But it is just a bizarre to me turn in her life that she was there and she was interested in it. I mean, at first I didn't even believe it when I read it the first time. I'm like, this guy's just making this up to fit his suspect. But then looking at objective, you know, DA and police reports, it happened. I mean, there's no doubt that she was there and she was involved with men that had knowledge about the crimes and that she was asking questions when she was there.
That is really strange. That is so really strange.
It's mind-blowing. Yeah. And part of me just wants to put it down to the concept that it was this incredibly small world and that if you were mixed up with sort of certain shady characters, I just don't really know what to think about all that.
I really wonder what she was trying to accomplish. You know, was she trying to? I mean, like, I just feel like in this immediate post-war era, if she was just trying to find a husband, I mean, she was pretty, she was young. There would have been people who were obliging. You know, I mean, there were lots of young women who had lost their sweethearts in the war, and you know, not all of them ended up drifting around the country. Certainly, I'm sure there were more than a few. But I mean, what was driving her? That's sort of
I think she was looking for fame, maybe in Hollywood. She was certainly looking for a husband and a connection. But I just don't know what the Chicago turn was all about. But she will then go from Chicago to Los Angeles. And it's notable, I think, at this time that I think the train company loses some of her luggage here on the trip from Chicago to L.A. And that will, after the murder in Los Angeles, that will be kind of a source of some clues as later again, I think it's the newspapers, I believe, track down her luggage before the police do.
Of course it is. They have better resources and more money.
Yeah.
And they actually care about solving the crime.
Yeah, they have a lot more motivation.
Yeah, but somewhere, I think from that summer, I think in June, May, June, July, she's going back and forth from first Massachusetts and Indianapolis and Chicago. And then I think she finally leaves Chicago, saying that she's going to go marry Gordon Fickling in Long Beach, California, in Los Angeles. But they don't end up getting married. I think they live together for a time in July, but ultimately they live together for a time and end up breaking up sometime, I think, in July or August of 1946.
Yeah. For which he's then made one of the initial suspects.
Sure, yeah. But I think he's, I believe he's actually moved on by the time of the crime, so he's not, he's a pretty solid alibi.
And he seems just like a pretty decent guy, actually, by all accounts.
Yeah.
We're still dealing with a fairly short period of time.
Correct. I mean, a lot of theorists try and establish her in Los Angeles, in California, in 1944 and 1945. I don't know what you guys think about that.
I don't think there's enough evidence, is there?
Yeah. My reading is from the evidence. Obviously, the police tried to establish that, and they could not establish her as being in Los Angeles from when she is shipped by juvenile authorities back to Massachusetts in 1943 till when she comes back in July of 1946. But that's open for debate, I guess. Bean, it sounds like you don't think there's enough evidence to establish her there, but it's certainly a possibility, I guess.
Yeah, I just think not proven.
Yeah.
As so much in this case.
Yeah. So it's really then in these six, or wait, from July to January, I guess, is 6 or 7 months in Hollywood that the Black Dahlia kind of legend is born. And she is kind of, again, in the words of a witness, prowling the boulevard, where she is very active in the Hollywood kind of nightlife.
I mean, it's important to say, I guess, that she is pretty. She does take care of how she dresses. She doesn't dress kind of provocatively. She's just immaculately put together. Perfect. You know, her hair's always done just so. She does wear the red lipstick that's the fashion at the time. She always makes sure she has her, you know, sort of neat new stockings. And, you know, she when you look at pictures of her, she's not at all dressed in a provocative way, but it's just very, she's actually aspiring to look very classy and perhaps even a little bit older than one might think. She's got a certain confidence about her, I think, from the photographs. And, you know, I guess what was controversial in the Times and how it was reported, maybe misreported, is evidently she was sexually experienced. Now, you can debate and discuss whether she was more so than most girls of her age at the time. It's just that they never had it exposed in such a way. I mean, 1946, 47 isn't that long before the 60s sexual revolution, but I suspect there was a lot more sex going on than people were talking about. It's just that when you have your entire dating life laid bare of course it can be made to seem horrific. So there's a spectrum of belief from probably people like me who think that she was dating and sleeping with guys, but it wasn't as ridiculous as out of the norms of the time. And then there's the kind of the middle ground that would be the kind of the Hearst view, that she was this kind of seductress and temptress and put herself in dangerous positions, and that she was a tramp. And then there's the sort of the Elroy fictionalized version, where she's an out and out prostitute, and then much more akin to the Jack the Ripper victims, who literally she had to go and sleep with men to pay for a room for the night. So yeah, it's kind of, I guess I'm interested in where you guys think she sits on that spectrum, from misunderstood girl of the times, fairly independent, sexually, you know, open, to full-on prostitution, I guess.
It's really hard to know for sure, to be honest, because of the way things got muddled and how this narrative was created post-mortem in the interest of selling papers. And that is the narrative that when I first learned about the Black Dahlia murder, it was, you know, that presented as she was this failed actress who had turned to the underworld to survive. And, you know, maybe that is true. I would like to think that she was a woman of her times who just got caught up in something, but I think it's kind of impossible to say. I think there is a lot of bizarre circumstantial evidence, like the sojourn in Chicago, to imply that she was, shall we say, mixed up in things, mixed up in some shady things. But, I mean, as we see, she was living a rather itinerant life.
So I'd like to
say that she was probably more than anything else a victim of circumstance.
Yeah,
there's this, I mean, obviously, like the kind of virgin whore dichotomy where you have to be one or the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie. I think it was a book, too. Kind of, what the heck's it called now? Ordinary Confessions, I think I want to say, with Robert Duvall and Robert De Niro, which is loosely based on this crime. And
No, I'll check it out.
I haven't seen it in like 30 years. I used to watch it a bunch of times when I was a kid on HBO when I was a kid, but I haven't seen it. I wanted to watch it before this, but they referred to her in that movie as the Virgin Tramp. And I think that's the awful kind of time that women were viewed through that kind of spectrum. And, you know, the truth is, I think what Bina said, she was promiscuous. I don't think there's any doubt about that, but that she wasn't a cock tease. She wasn't a prostitute. She was just a woman or a girl who was living her life, and she did occasionally have dates and sex with men. And that's awful that it ends up that might have what cost her life, but she just lived her life in a way where she was often put herself kind of at the mercy of the kindness of strangers. In these months in Los Angeles, rather, where she didn't have a job and she was often kind of relying on men to take her out on a date for a meal. And sometimes she had sex with them, sometimes she didn't, you know, and that's perfectly her prerogative.
Mm-hmm.
But it's she certainly wasn't a prostitute in my mind, even like the Jack the Ripper victims where she was sleeping in exchange for DOS money or something. She just, more often than not, was going on dates to get a meal. And occasionally she'd meet a guy that she liked and she'd have sex with him. Occasionally she'd meet someone that was nice and she'd hit them up for a loan or rent money. But I don't think she was in any way a prostitute or anything particularly out of the ordinary for a big city young woman who was actively dating.
Just a young woman trying to make her way, and I think it's just safe to say that we'll talk about this some more probably presently. She got caught up in some shit.
Yeah, ultimately.
And as we've already talked about, the environment in LA back then, you know, these four heads of the dragon, shall we say. We always got to get a Song of Ice and Fire reference in. I mean, let's be honest here. With the local government, the mob, Hollywood, and the press, and something. She came across something or someone.
Correct.
All I can say is that this was a town primed, that when they saw a remotely vulnerable young girl who was susceptible, and I think actually in her case, it probably wasn't even susceptible to the casting couch and being told, I can put you in a movie, but actually susceptible to being told, you know, okay, I want to sleep with you and have a good time, but I will, at the end of the day, there might be something serious. Like, I think she would have been susceptible to that. And this was a town that swallowed young, vulnerable girls whole, and maybe still does, I don't know.
Yeah, still do. I mean, it's changed, obviously, I'm sure it still happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's held up as this cautionary tale, right, of of what can happen in Los Angeles to a young woman.
I mean, I could go down there solo for a weekend and not end up getting murdered, you know.
Sure.
But
if you're a runaway or something and you're 18 years old or you're,
the chances of you getting exploited
preyed upon is...
And maybe
I have an unreal illusion of what Los Angeles was and is, but that's certainly my biased opinion of Los Angeles.
And maybe it's kind of like supply creates its own demand. Maybe it's that any town would have its element that would exploit a young waif, but that Los Angeles happens to attract those people because it does have that you know, the merchandising of the Hollywood myth. That come here, your dreams can come true. It's the land where the sun always shines, you know? I mean, I think it's...
Yeah, you'll get discovered in a pharmacy and you'll become, you know, America's sweetheart or something like that.
Exactly. I don't like Los Angeles. So there's that.
I feel the same, though. I've never been there.
Yeah.
I've been there. I think it's just, I don't dislike it. I just think it's strange. It's just a strange place. She wasn't in that mall because I don't think she was trying to be an actress, or maybe just kind of maybe played with the idea, but...
Yeah, I don't see, just from what I've looked, I mean, like, just like looking from the Wikipedia article, I see nothing about her being an aspiring slash failed actress. That must have been an invention from later.
Yeah, I think that that's part of the myth a little bit. I think she was open to it, and there, I think in the bars of those times, there were certainly probably guys that were quote-unquote talent agents from Columbia Pictures or something were kind of trying on the make. But again, she lies a lot in her letters, but I think most, you know, I don't know if she ever really was in the casting process or anything like that. But
you know, some of her lies, I feel, are the sort of lies one would tell. They're white lies. Like, you know, if you write back home and you say, you know, I got a small part in this film, or I got a, you know, you're just trying to make everyone not worry about you and think
she's
that everything's going well. You know, you, when you're writing your mum when you first go to college, you don't say, oh, I'm miserable, I cry in my room every night. You say, actually, yeah, I went to a cool part. You know, I think it's kind of like some of it is just a young girl. Sometimes when you're writing home, you can pretend things are going better and make yourself feel like they're going better than they are. And I just think it makes her even more tragic. It's not that she's this compulsive liar who can't, you know, yes, she lies.
I agree 100%. I mean, obviously, like you said, that's kind of the disconnect when her mother, and we'll get to how the story of her mother coming to California.
Oh,
but,
so horrible.
Know, but that's the disconnect. I think she's written her mother telling these white lies. And maybe I'm being unfair when I say she lies in her letters and stuff. But it's just that. She's just telling her mother that she has a job when she doesn't have a job. And that things are going well when things aren't going great and stuff like that.
Why
and
would you worry your mom? Exactly. I mean, yeah.
Well, it's also nice to know that the sort of motto of coming out to California is the same now as it was then. Fake it till you make it.
So why don't we, since we brought it up, does someone want to tell the story of how Phoebe Short ended up being notified about the death of her daughter?
Ugh. Yeah.
And kind of just the awfulness of the whole thing.
But then this is also contested, right? Like, anyway.
I think a little bit. I think the story is true, but the exact kind of cruelty of it.
The degree of the horror showness of it.
As far as I know, the only thing that's up for debate is kind of the degree of the cruelty. But I might be wrong.
The story is horrific. That effectively one of the newspapers rings up the mum and says, "Look, your daughter's won a beauty pageant, and we're writing a story, so we'd love to get all the info on, you know, all the lovely, charming stories about when she was growing up and, you know, what were her interests and what were her dreams when she came out to California? Are you so excited that she's, you know, won this award and blah, blah, blah?" And only when they've milked her for all this lovely emotional stuff and put her in this wonderful, happy place, do they then reveal that actually her daughter's been murdered. And it's just so epically horrific.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the long and short of it, basically, you know?
It's unimaginable, right? It's just, you can't even begin to think what...
I mean, I live in a country with perhaps one of the most horrific tabloid cultures in the world, which actually I perversely quite like, because I think it keeps our politicians quite honest. I don't think that Trump would exist in the UK just because of what The Sun would do to him, The Sun being one of our worst tabloid newspapers. But we did have an awful murder of a teenage girl called Millie Dowler, and it was discovered that The Sun had hacked her phone and deleted some of the voicemail before her parents could hear, and that caused sort of national... In fact, that closed. The newspaper that did that, the News of the World, no longer exists because of the scandal caused.
They went in and I mean, I know they ultimately caught a suspect, and I believe it was determined that he was, you know, the murderer, But I mean, like, that's messing with a murder investigation.
Exactly. But that's what happens here again. And it is genuinely
again and again
the murder investigation is messed with. And but here it's just mental cruelty to lift up this poor mother who doesn't hear that often from her daughter. Oh, she's done this amazing thing. Fantastic. It's all finally happening for her. And then say, well, sorry, by the way. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. I had not heard that story. And that is, that is so Hollywood. Okay, anyway.
It's just horrific. And it's just, it's absolutely emblematic of, you know, and as Thomas said, you know, you had 4 editions of a newspaper and you had to sell it. So what do you do? How do you get the scoop? So they would argue. They would argue that they had to, like, that was the pressure they were under.
Yeah, I'm a strong believer in the free market, but you can see here where kind of this free market competition between these multiple news sources, it just kind of leads to almost the worst, sensationalized, you know, and that's on, again, that's on the public because that's what they want, but leads just the worst ethical treatment of the victims here.
Yeah.
Time and again. So that brings us, I guess, kind of to the crime taking place and now into the investigation, I guess, which again is an investigation that, as we've kind of stressed time and again, is led often more by the media because they have resources and kind of they just work 24 hours a day where the cops are just clocking in and out. And that's not a shot against the homicide detectives in this case, I think, and we'll get to maybe some of their opinions after the fact, but that they were not, in my opinion, crooked cops. They were genuinely interested in pursuing every lead as far as they could in finding the murderer.
The individual detectives, I think, were honest, and I think the problem is that what do you do when you get to a crime scene and that the people are already there taking pictures. You might want to withhold certain bits of information so that you can quiz the you know, obvious number of nutters who are going to ring up and claim to have done it. How can you do that? The evidence has probably been tampered with. People have been stepping around the body, disturbing the crime scene. I think it's their task was difficult. And if you go and interview a witness and 3 other journalists have been there and interviewed them beforehand, it just becomes a joke. It reminds me, actually, just maybe because the OJ stuff's in the news at the moment, a bit of OJ, that how do you control an investigation of that kind, you know?
Yeah, it's a crime, again, where the body is meticulously posed and you have a crime scene which is contaminated. And I think the police, for their time and place, did as good a job as they could, but they weren't there first, and I think the police tried to maintain... I mean, if you look at the pictures, the media is not on the grass and stuff, but they're on the sidewalk a foot away, and there are footprints, and there are tire tracks that are potentially everything is contaminated and blood splatter and stuff. But I think the cops on the ground weren't up to anything ill, you know. Didn't have any nefarious intentions, but that's
I don't also. And actually, when you read some of the more sort of cover-up-y type stuff, they never really are against the individual cops on the ground. It's always about people far higher up just calling, you know, covering stuff up and calling off the investigation rather than the actual, you know, the collecting of the evidence and the blood work and all that sort of stuff.
But again, the press is there and they have a relationship with the police and they have knowledge that the police don't want to get out. And there is that kind of quid pro quo relationship that exists and sometimes helpful, whether it's right or wrong. And then sometimes it's not at all helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, where do you guys... Go ahead.
No, I just agree.
Do we want to go into... What do we want to go into next? Maybe the mailing of her
person's
stuff? Belongings?
Yeah, or, I guess so.
Well, I did not know. She's buried in Oakland. I could go to her grave right now, you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy crap, I think I should.
I think we probably should pay respects.
Leave some flowers, yeah.
Yeah, after we're doing this thing and digging it all up again, it probably would behoove us to do that.
I don't think I can go today, but I could go tomorrow. Oh, no, I really could.
Well,
I think
be great.
I should.
Yeah,
she did have family in Northern California, and that is...
Mm-hmm. If her dad was still alive at this point, and he was kicking around there, because Vallejo is right by Oakland.
Yeah.
Her dad moves to Los Angeles, I think, with Betty at the time, but I think her sister lived in Northern California, and that's where she ends up being buried.
And probably the reason for Oakland is in the Bay Area, there are two communities that sort of have the concentrations of cemeteries, Colma in the south and Oakland in the northeast, if you will. So that probably explains that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the investigate... I'm sorry.
I was going to say, no, I know what I'm doing tomorrow. Wow.
Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Send you money for flowers.
Well, I'm not going to lay black dahlias because I think that's
cheesy.
That's respectful.
No, mm-hmm. Just white lilies or something, and I'll.
Yeah, no, just something nice.
Yeah.
So the investigation is kind of ongoing in the week after Elizabeth Short's identified. There's an autopsy, which I think is taking place basically at the same time. Her fingerprints are going to Washington, D.C. And I don't know if may I'll just read what I have for the autopsy. And certainly if you don't want to hear this stuff, but I think it's kind of important to lay out exactly the overkill and mutilation. And again, if you don't want to listen to this, it's awful stuff. So. But I'm just going to quote now from what I have. Deep laceration on the face, 3 inches long, which extends laterally from the right corner of the mouth. There's also a deep laceration, 2.5 inches long, that extends laterally from the left corner of the mouth. And again, this is that Glasgow smile or Chelsea smile that we talked about in a horrific... Severe bruising was present in several places on Short's head and neck, and there were also several small cuts on her upper lip. However, the hyoid bone was attacked, and there was no evidence of trauma near the thyroid glands or trachea, which would be indicative of strangulation. Multiple cuts and scratches also marked her chest, torso, and arms. A small square-shaped piece of skin was missing from her thigh. And I believe this piece of skin contained a small rose tattoo. This bit of skin was later found shoved into her vagina along with a fair amount of grass.
Mm.
Yeah. It also appeared that Elizabeth Short had been sodomized post-mortem. Her stomach was filled with a greenish-brown granular matter that was mostly feces and other particles which could not be identified. There was no sperm found on her body. Elizabeth Short was tortured before and after death, and in the end, it was the injuries to her face, the head, and mouth that caused her death. After death, she was, again, surgically bifurcated. She wasn't like sawed in half. She was expertly, in the opinion of the doctors and the police at the time, bisected in a surgery. I think it's called a hymeroctopy. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's the specific surgery in which between two lumbars of the spine, the body can be kind of cut in half, and it's done in extreme cases of injury to the lower portions of the body. And then her, again, at the crime scene, all of her organs, as far as I know, were present, and they were stuffed neatly into her upper and lower parts of her body. And then she had that cut in her abdomen, which was consistent with a hysterectomy. But
maybe that's
what
I'm getting confused about then.
Yeah, from what I read, there was nothing actually removed.
Okay.
And again, you can kind of, there are, if you are interested, and whether you are or not is up to you, I'm not going to judge, but there you can find both the crime scene photos and her autopsy photos online if you want. And we talked about this when Mary Kelly's murder, the crime scene is just absolutely horrific with Jack the Ripper, but there's a certain kind of uncontrolled violence to that scene, which... opposed to the Elizabeth Short's murder, where this was there was clearly a level of control.
Mm-hmm, very much so.
And I think maybe even surgical skill involved.
Yeah, no, there. I feel like there are some thematic, shall we say, similarities between this and Mary Kelly. I don't know if it's just because there's photographs of both, yeah. And there's just and you get the sense that both killers were trying to get. And this is something I said in our Jack the Ripper series: is you feel like the killer / killers were trying to get to the essence of her and destroy the essence of this person.
There's very much an effort to, I think, humiliate and dehumanize Elizabeth Short in a way it's kind of hard to wrap your head around. But
it's an extremely technically sadistic murder, and I think this will be something we explore more when we look at one of the potential suspects. Like, it's literally a textbook sadistic ritual humiliation. But like I say, we can talk about that more when we get to Mr. Hodel.
Yeah, but the mutilations to the face, what was done around the genital area. I mean, it's humiliation.
And actually, the thing about like the Ripper is he was horrific, but the pain suffered by the women was very. It was horrific. I don't want to minimize it at all, but these were very quick killings.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Short was alive and tortured for hours, if not days.
Yeah, because she wasn't. Another thing that we haven't noted is that she was missing for like a week before her body was found.
Yeah, potentially, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, so there is a myth or a truth, however you want to look at it, of a quote unquote missing week. And that's what the detectives are going to find when they're investigating the movement and location of Elizabeth Short in the months and days leading up to her discovery at 39th and Norton. And I guess what we're talking about here with the missing week is the police were able to really kind of locate Elizabeth Short up to, I think, January 9th, correct? They'd found everywhere she'd stayed and kind of moved in Los Angeles up until, I think, beginning of December when she takes a bus to San Diego, and she ends up living with a family in San Diego all through December. And in San Diego, she meets a man named Red Manley, who ends up, she dates, I'll say, and he ends up driving her back to Los Angeles, I believe on January 9th. And then on January 9th, he leaves her at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. And then from January 9th to January 15th, when her body is discovered, is this, quote, missing week, unquote. And the police, and I tend to agree with them, were never able to corroborate her movements during that week. There's a series of witnesses after the fact that will claim that they had seen her on various days and at various places. And I don't know if you guys want to talk about it in detail here, and maybe I'll just move stuff around in the editing process. But so this week is obviously of great import. she's obviously going to meet her killer if she doesn't already know him or them. But it's trying to establish during this week where she was, who she was with. It's ultimately going to be central to the investigation of her murder. And what are your guys' thoughts on this week? And we can go through some specific cases if you want, or evidence or witnesses if you like, but just in general.
Yeah, Julie, do you want to go first?
I'm sorry, we're doing that what now?
The missing week.
I was just, if you wanted to talk about the missing week and
I'm not sure what
last to... yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that my favorite suspect is obviously George Hodel. And I think that the missing week plays nicely into the whole fact that she was obviously kept alive for an extended period of time and tortured. So probably for at least part of that missing week, she was in the hands of her killers.
For sure.
Yeah.
So that's what I think in the missing week. But I don't know.
But whether it's a whole week, I think, is up for question. I think I think you're right that there are these witnesses that come forward after the fact, and some of it's not even like first-time witnesses. It's a friend of a friend told me that they saw her.
Correct. Some of these witnesses are familiar with. They're not just people that are after the fact seeing Elizabeth Short's picture in the paper and saying, "I saw that woman." Some of these people are former are acquaintances of Elizabeth Short during this week that you would think would know what they're talking about. Obviously, sometimes it's hard to know exactly what day, whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday you saw someone, or whether it was at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, you know, but some of these people have reason to know when they say they saw Elizabeth Short.
Yeah, so I don't believe it was a missing week, insofar as I think some of the gaps can probably be filled.
Yeah.
Definitely she was probably held for 2 to 3 days minimum, but I think some of these witnesses were right, and I think the fact that maybe they weren't followed up, I mean, like, I don't believe everything that Steve Hodell writes, but I think some of what he's uncovered probably is right, and again, it just speaks to what was going on with the LAPD, and not necessarily with Volition, but kind of, I don't know, yeah, missed opportunities to kind of lock stuff down, maybe. But what do you think?
I don't know what to think, I guess. What is the purpose of the police kind of specifically establishing, you know, this week where she's not seen, when there are, again, people that have every reason to recognize her? Not just, I mean, I think some of them are just mistaken. They're just, they saw a black-haired woman and they believe that they were part of this story when they weren't. But there were other people that knew who she was and saw her during those days. And then there's the last person is a police officer. And I guess I can see why the police would not want a female police officer, not that it matters, but would not want that one to be accurate, because it's like that's the day before she was probably murdered and there were suspicious circumstances. And why didn't this police officer kind of follow through and potentially got her out of that situation? But so I can see why the police would kind of say, well, that one doesn't, probably wasn't her. But the rest of them, I don't know what's in the police's, why they would go and try and specifically undermine all of these witnesses. So it's whether you want to believe the police's take that they could not corroborate this stuff, or if this stuff should be taken with more of a degree of certainty. So I don't know where I come down on it.
Mm-hmm. And whether or not it means anything at all.
Yeah, I mean,
a slight problem with this whole thing, isn't it? That trying to read, sometimes you feel, oh my God, have I got kind of conspiracy nut kind of mayhem, and I'm just reading way too much into stuff, and it's
well, tricky. A lot of it depends on if you have a suspect and who that suspect is.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the missing week can be used by various people to justify certain suspects, I guess it's fair to say.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, like, for example, as I've already said, if Hodell is your suspect, that missing week helps you out a lot. Because, like I said, like, I mean, I don't know if we want to get into that already,
sure,
but
we will. But
I'm going to save that for our suspects.
Okay.
Discussion.
We'll move along. I just wanted to say one thing. I guess at the autopsy, the time of death was determined to be, I think, was it like 10 hours or so before the body was discovered? I don't know. I'm not a doctor, obviously. I feel like determining the time of death of a body.
That's been exterminated.
Yeah, exactly. And determining the death of the body that has no blood in it and has been cut in half are two different things, but I don't know enough about it to question the time of death. So I think the time of death is determined to be late January 14th or early January 15th, one way or the other, that morning the body is discovered. And then again, the body, once it's moved, there was dew underneath the body, and that dew would have formed on the ground around 2 a.m. in the morning. So the body was placed sometime after 2 a.m. that morning, and the police believed that the body was killed the same day that it was discovered. So it's probably important just to state those, and I'll call them facts. Again, though, I don't know for certain enough about determining the time of death of a body to question their finding.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Okay, so we'll just, I mean, we'll move through some of the other things quickly. About a week after the body was discovered, and whether you believe this is part of it or not, the kind of leads had kind of died down, and the kind of started to not be above the fold front page headline news. At that time, I think most likely the killer or killers, though I guess not 100% sure, mails a postcard to the LA Examiner, which is, again, the chief paper that's kind of moving the story, which consists of collage cutout letters saying that they are going to send the Black Dahlia's belongings to the newspaper soon. The letter, I think it was a letter, was doused in gasoline and kind of steps were taken. Obviously, there was no handwriting, and steps were taken to remove fingerprints. And then the Examiner contacted the police, and it was agreed that when the contents were sent, that they would be opened in the presence, again, of the Los Angeles Examiner.
Which is amazing to concede. Yeah. I mean, the police don't have to let that happen. Like, they just don't realize the power they have or exercise the power they have. It's just amazing to me. But anyway, sorry.
Well, I mean, there has to be a certain amount of complicity. Just, you know, that's just my opinion, but...
Yeah.
So, again, this puts... we should maybe said at this point the name originally was like the Werewolf Killer or some name like that was given to the crime, but in investigating Elizabeth Short's movements, they discovered that, and again, this is a myth, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that Elizabeth Short had frequented, I believe, a pharmacy, which is, again, like a soda jerk at the time, and drank soda and ate snacks and read magazines there, and that the men, so like the servicemen that frequented that place, had taken to calling her the Black Dahlia.
But was that really true, though? Or is that just... Because there was a big movie out called The Blue Dahlia, right? So to
correct,
me, it was a bit sort of all the president's men using the sort of the deep throat thing. Or was that just something that they wanted to use and that was the... convenient.
Again, like so much, is it a myth or is it reality?
Yeah.
Is kind of lost to us. But either way,
in Hollywood, you can create yourself.
Yeah.
Or someone else will do it for you.
You know, why tell the truth when you can tell a good story, I guess. But so that's how the Black Dahlia name came to be adopted into this story. And that kind of moved a lot of newspapers. And kind of set up, again, this kind of, you know, Delilah, Dahlia, this temptress, this kind of put this whole kind of noir romantic cast to it that sold papers and played into whether there was any truth to it or not. I don't know if anyone would ever know.
Yeah, it just feels to me too hokey and easy. That feels to me completely like a sort of a post facto justification of a cool name that the newspapers thought up.
Yeah. Later, like shortly after then, a gasoline soaked envelope containing Elizabeth Short's birth certificate, an address book, a Greyhound baggage claim check, 6 snapshots, a social security card, and a newspaper clipping, relating the facts of the death of, again, that Captain Matthew Gordon. And there were some, I think some other photographs as well, were mailed to the Examiner. And that was going to then drive the investigation a lot, because the address book had belonged to Mark Hansen, who was a local businessman. So he owned nightclubs and burlesque shows and that kind of thing.
I was going to say, that helps feed into that sort of like more raunchy side of the Dahlia myth, because... Yeah, he does own a burlesque show, and you know, it's I mean, that's manner to the gutter press.
Yeah, and it's going to turn out that Elizabeth Short had roomed at he kind of owned a nightclub with a burlesque show, and he owned a house behind it.
And normally, the girls who room there ended up performing for him, or you know, so yeah. I mean,
so the girls that worked there ended up living at his house. sometimes free of rent, sometimes quid pro quo, sometimes they paid rent, and Elizabeth Short lives there for a time here after July and before January. And Hansen and his kind of circle are going to become suspects and people of interest in this story and in the investigation.
Although, what's your view? So, I tend to think he was just a sleazy guy who was kind of guilty of stuff and not, you know, like, wrong place, wrong time kind of thing.
I agree. I think he's just, I don't think he is directly or in, maybe indirectly in that, but I don't think he was directly involved in the murder itself. Again, the address book is something that Elizabeth Short likely lifted from his house when she lived there. And it was full of lots of names and addresses, as well as lots of pages and entries which were cut out and removed. So it's hard to tell who did that, whether she did that, whether the killer or killers did that. But this is going to be lots of grist for the newspapers and lots of leads for the police to investigate.
And speaks, I think, to the mind of a killer who thinks he's above the police, can taunt them, play with them, and still from a place of complete safety and genius.
Yeah.
High on a hill, if you will.
It's not, I mean, nothing about this crime is common, right? The murder mutilation. I mean, it's something you see in movies and stuff, but generally speaking, killers don't taunt the police and the newspapers. Yes.
Things are, and again, this is something I believe I said in the Jack the Ripper episodes, was things are usually a lot more straightforward than this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the case of Jack the Ripper, I personally believe almost all of the correspondence was not
real
from the actual killer. But here it's very hard. I mean, you can come up with a scenario where this wasn't sent by the killer, but it's almost impossible that the killer did not send this stuff.
It's possible that the killer was inspired by what he thought was what the Ripper had done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly possible.
We think he didn't.
Then was later on, was the Zodiac inspired by this and the Ripper?
Exactly.
Or if you believe Steve Hodell, was George Hodell the Zodiac as well as the Black Dahlia Avenger?
Ugh.
Okay. So, and there were a lot of cranks in this case as well. People that sent letters, people that confessed to stuff, and that's going to consume a lot of the investigation, these cranks, because, you know, they have to investigate, they have to check alibis, they have to thoroughly eliminate these people, and that's going to waste a lot of time always in these kind of investigations. And the reasons why we discussed again with the Ripper, why people are compelled to do this kind of thing, is beyond me, but it's something that happens.
I just think you chalk it up to mental illness, don't you?
I feel like in the Ripper case, there were people writing letters that were not kooks. They were just average people. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but
wanting to be part of a big story?
Yeah. Why you want to insert yourself into it, I don't know.
But then aren't we doing that a little bit?
I guess we're not disrupting an investigation. I don't know.
Yeah, true.
And this is kind of a post-mortem. I don't know. I shouldn't judge lest I be judged, I guess. And my mental sanity is in question, without a doubt.
We've been talking about the Black Dahlia, and we're going to talk about suspects next time. But obviously, this comes in the back of discussing the Ripper and H.H. Holmes, who were definitely serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you think this is a serial killer? And maybe related to that, because we normally, when, you know, new people come onto Vassals of Kingsgrave, you say, how did he get into the books? How did he get in the show? Like, why did we pick the Dahlia? Like, why is this the case? What is your relationship to it? Like, with Jack the Ripper, I had this very logistical, I'd been fascinated in Victorian London for a long time. I was really into the topography of it. With H.H. Holmes, it was basically on the back of a particular book. With Dahlia, wasn't something that, I don't know, I just find it interesting how I've become quite enveloped in this. So I would be interested to know with the rest of you how you got into it, and also whether you do think it's a serial killer or not. And maybe that's a cool way to get people tantalized for the next episode when we really go into suspects.
Yeah, I'd be happy to speak to both of those. Just like with Jack the Ripper, I have from a very young age been interested into these darker sides of history. whether it's, you know, more of the paranormal or just these very bizarre crimes, very bizarre incidents. And I don't remember exactly when I came across Black Dahlia, if it was, say, a History Channel special or if it was in a book, or it may have been online, actually. It's just one of those things that I saw it, I consumed it, and I was disturbed by it, but also it stayed with me because that's the nature of this crime and this unfortunate person's life and ending. It's upsetting. It flies in the face of life itself. It's offensive to anyone that has a shred of decency to them. And also it gets under your skin. It fascinates that darker side of human nature. So it's this repulsion and attraction thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very much a rabbit hole. I don't have, like with Jack the Ripper, I've been interested in Jack the Ripper since I was a young kid, probably way too young. And I don't have that same level of interest, or did not have that same level of interest in the Black Dahlia. I guess I was always aware of the myth, but not a lot of the details. Like I said, when I was May 12 or 13, I did watch, I think it's called True Confessions. I got to look up the actual name of that and put in the right name. That Robert De Niro, he plays a priest, and his brother, Robert Duvall plays a police officer. And I did watch that a bunch when I was a kid, or 12, 13, an adolescent. But I never read a book about the Black Dahlia, and I remember probably when I was a teenager, Hollywood Babylon came out, and with kind of like the sensationalized actual crime scene photos were kind of showed for the first time. And I remember actively staying away from that book because I thought that was kind of repulsive and just kind of sensationalistic. So I never, beyond the myth of then later reading the James Ellroy novel and watching kind of movies and stuff, I never really got deep into it. And then I think when we were discussing what the next killer we were going to look at was, we'd kind of discussed the Zodiac, and I had not read a Zodiac book in a long time. So I figured I'd pick up something more recent than what I had read. And I came across the Steve Hodell's books, where he kind of links the Black Dahlia and the Zodiac together. And I had mentioned that on the forums, I think, and Bina had saw it and immediately kind of suggested we do the Black Dahlia next. And so that was kind of then for me kind of a crash course, which is a disappointing one in a lot of ways. I don't think there is a great book, a dry history of the Black Dahlia, of Elizabeth Short's life and death. Yeah. So you really have to read a lot of what I think are crappy books, or not great books, at least. And with the internet, there's a lot of information out there. So that's kind of my Black Dahlia history. Whether I think, it's hard for me to look at this murder site and say this was the first person that this killer killed. It's just very difficult to say that this person's first act of lethal violence was Elizabeth Short.
To my opinion on that, there's absolutely no way this was their first murder. There's just no way.
So that would be I just don't see it. I mean, I think there's like just the slightest possibility that this was an insane act of surrealist art, which is insane to even say out loud. I think that's a possibility, that this was an actual calculated piece of surrealist art. And I'm sure we'll get into that in part two, but I feel crazy even saying that.
The way that fits, you know, is that it was a ritualistic murder.
Yeah.
If it was art in this person's head, what is art? Okay, I can't. Yeah. I just said that. Oh my God. So don't feel bad for going down that route, because you're getting into a killer's head, and that's not a good place to be.
So it's hard to imagine this person only killed Elizabeth Short, never killed anyone before or after. But I think there's a small possibility that that's the truth. And I'm sure that is something we're going to discuss in great detail in our second volume, which is needs to be scheduled. And we will get into the suspects and kind of the culture more and the cultural significance before and after, which we've discussed a little bit, but of the Elizabeth Short martyr and the Black Dahlia myth. And I just want to thank Julia and Bina for participating. And if you did choose to listen to this, I hope you learned something. And
Come back for part two.
Come back for part two. And all due respect to the victim.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. All due respect to the victim. And thank you, Thomas, for hosting. Because I think it's hard to know kind of how to enter. Like how to... there's so much going on with this. It's not the easiest thing to organize.
But you know what? I am going to do my darndest to get up to Oakland tomorrow and go find her grave and go lay some flowers on all of our behalf.
Thank you.
And I'll take pictures.
Appreciate that.